On this week's 51%, we have a look at music and the arts. First with musician Ani DiFranco.
I feel like my feminism has evolved beyond myself. I consider now, you know, feminism to be the most expedient path away from patriarchy.
Then we hear about an exhibit on performance art and meet art and music therapists who are helping veterans. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I am not an angry girl, but it seems like I've got everyone fooled. Every time I say something they find hard to hear, they chalk it up to my anger and never to their own fear. Imagine you're a girl just trying to finally complain, knowing full well they've...
Feminist Ani DiFranco is a musician and an activist known for her female empowerment themes, and she is on her Rise Up tour. 51%'s Josh Landy's caught up with DiFranco to get her take on what has changed in her world of music and feminism.
Ani, you've been writing and recording and releasing music for almost 30 years now. What's changed about your practice in 2018 since you started in the late 80s?
Wow, what's changed? Just about everything, except for that acoustic guitar that I hold next to me. I feel like I've been through so many lifetimes since I began making music, and they're all out there on record, so there's that. But, I guess the most startling change in the last 10 years or so is being a mother. I just no longer have license to do what I do or immerse myself in my art or playing or my tiny thoughts like I used to. I have to do it on the sly now.
So how do you do that? How do you balance motherhood and this creative life that you lead?
It is tricky. It's just plumb tricky. I mean, my kids basically are threatened by my music. You know, it was sort of my songs are my first child, you know, my first children. And so both kids, I have an 11-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they seem pretty clear from the beginning that, you know, even if they're playing happily by themselves for a moment, if I pick up the guitar, they will turn right around and make me put it down and make me focus on them. You know, they're very jealous. So I do a lot of my writing and playing and trying to catch up on my own work when I'm on tour now. I feel like when I hit the road and I'm away from my kids, it's sort of, you know, songwriter boot camp for me.
So in a way, are you relearning this practice in this new context?
It's just hard. I mean, my kids, you know, especially I got the 5-year-old, you know, so they're still young and they're still very needy and they eat my head on a daily basis, you know. So I find I have to go back on tour, you know, very out of my thing, you know, that my kids pull me so far into mom land that then I feel it's a very surreal experience now to suddenly be on stage again going, oh man, how does my stuff go? Who am I? I don't, you know. So it's a bit schizophrenic these days, but I imagine someday, you know, I'll have all the time in the world again to play guitar and I'll miss those kids eating my head.
Is it strange from this new vantage point in your life to go back and revisit compositions from many years ago where I assume you're writing from a very different place as a person?
Many of them are way forgotten by me, you know, and even the consciousness that gave birth to them is forgotten, you know. As I say, there's been so many Anis along the way. But many of them I still know. I relearn old songs out of, curiosity myself, and it's an interesting experience to play a song that's 20 years old or something and re-embody it. You know, I find that even singing the same words, it's a different experience when you're standing in a different place singing them, you know, and the words may be the same, but the tone shifts and the inflection is different.
2018 is a time of incredibly pitched political discord in America, and I know you've always been an outspoken artist with putting your politics forefront in your music. What are you responding to in the ether right now that's coming out in your music in 2018?
Well, here's the crazy thing. I've been writing a book for a year and a half. A year and a half. So I haven't been writing new songs. I can't believe that I've written a book, again, in the context of the mom world. I have been sneakily writing a book, and I'm almost done. It's a memoir. So I've been pouring all of my, you know, my writing and my creativity into this book, which is an interesting, place for me to be in this political moment. Like you say, there is so much happening on a daily basis to respond to. And I've been working on a project that involves, you know, talking and thinking, writing about the past. I felt along the way, you know, certainly from the last presidential election onward, I've been receiving many messages from the world of, Ani, bring it on. Where's the songs? We're ready. Okay, I'm ready. Okay, bring it on. You know, and I'm sitting at my laptop trying to make complete sentences. So it's been a sort of a weird time for me. And I hope I'm just about done with it, and it's going to come out, I don't know when. But I hope that it will also, in its elusive way, speak to this moment and do the work that the songs are not right now.
So speaking of this moment, from your vantage point in the world of music, how is the Me Too movement affecting how people communicate on a day-to-day level, person to person?
I mean, I think this Me Too movement, you know, is indicative of the fact that women's experiences are becoming more real in general society, which is to say in patriarchal society. The lives of women are hitting the radar. Women are every day becoming more recognized as full human beings. We still have a long way to go around the globe towards women's equality and emancipation. But you can just see with, you know, this, you know, sexual harassment. I mean, the sexism, misogyny is so deeply embedded in our culture, in the sort of patriarchal cultures around the world. And it just seems like the way it is. Like it's hard for us to even stand back collectively and acknowledge patriarchy, let alone, address it, you know. So you see in these new glimmerings of women's stories being put out there in the public sphere and considered, and the sort of subtle shifts in society and culture when you begin to recognize these alternative experiences other than the dominant ones that we are so familiar with. It's a process. It's a process of inclusion. Women have been working for so many generations to be included, you know, to have their voices included, to participate in culture, in politics, in society. And you see that sort of wall giving way a little bit now. And that's very thrilling. It's very thrilling for me to feel less like a voice in the wilderness, you know, when I'm talking about patriarchy or something, you know, dropping the P word into polite conversation. I feel that there is more receptiveness now than I've ever felt. I feel like less of a freak of nature and much more willingness in people around me to engage about it.
Do you feel like feminism as an idea has changed today in how it's defined or how it's perceived by our culture?
Yeah, certainly. It changes across time. Also, it changes based on the person you're talking to quite radically. You know, I think it's something that everybody, you know, embodies and considers in their own way. My own personal feminism has evolved a lot over the course of my life. It began very immediate and very bodily based, you know, this sort of power, daily power dynamic that I was living in the world of men. And my feminism was sort of a tool for which I was sort of trying to elbow out space for myself, my legitimate, authentic self in this world, you know, where I was feeling like a square peg in a round hole. But over the decades, I feel like my feminism has evolved beyond myself. I consider now, you know, feminism to be the most expedient path away from patriarchy. And I think that that is a path that is necessary for all people now, not just women, or this is my understanding of it now, you know, that patriarchy, this fundamental imbalance that underlies human society, is the source of many rivers of imbalance, of social disease. You know, I look at natural law and I see that balance is the basis of peace. You know, whether you're talking about an ecosystem or a government, a society, you know, in a physical body, you know, perfection is not what we need to strive for, but balance is the prerequisite to peace, you know. So I think that when we start with the fundamental imbalance of patriarchy, we just can't achieve peace on earth. So, you know, these days, my understanding of feminism is sort of a path to peace on earth for all of us, men and women, all of us hurt by this patriarchal structure.
Well, speaking of that societal imbalance, President Trump has proven to be, in many ways, a discordant element in American society today. He's a very controversial figure and has provoked a great deal of debate and conversation about patriarchy and the presidency and our culture at large in America.
Indeed.
So how do, as a culture, with a leader that has proven to be as, again, to use your term, imbalancing as President Trump, how do we restore that balance outside of the halls of power?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a frightful time, but a time of great possibility. You know, it's so many things at once, you know. I mean, this is a time of great political regression, as we know. But also, in a backwards way, that man has been a great uniter, has he not? You know, our idea of us has never looked broader next to him and them. You know, I feel like our sense of us is growing stronger in relationship to such an oppressive force. So, you know, it's remarkable how much sort of unity and energy is being invested now in the resistance. In many ways, is a blessing in disguise to have a figure like Trump pulling back the curtains on, you know, the deeply, deeply rooted imbalances of patriarchy and racism and classism and all of these things that are so huge, these forces, you know, but can be... can be disguised in so many crafty ways. So here we have the opposite of a craftsman. We have a buffoon who is exposing all of these things in this startling new way, and therefore they're more visible, they're more accessible, they're something that we can address more effectively in this atmosphere. So I try to focus on that, you know. Just the remarkable energy of resistance all around me.
That was musician and activist Ani DeFranco, who is on her Rise Up tour. She was speaking with 51%'s Josh Landes. In the 1990s, queer performance artists like Karen Finley created radical, experimental, and often politically risky work. These artists rebelled against Reagan-Bush politics, the AIDS crisis, Senator Jesse Helms' attack on the National Endowment for the Arts, and the era's culture wars. An exhibit curated by Gwyneth Shanks, A Different Kind of Intimacy, Queer and Radical Performance at the Walker in 1990-1995, chronicles the era, and that's the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis. KFAI's Dixie Trichel produced this story.
One can assume that one cockroach in one soup is one cockroach too many. And I feel the same way about the National Endowment for the Arts.
My name is Gwen Shanks, and I'm the curator of A Different Kind of Intimacy, a rather specific time period in the Walker's history, 1990 to 1995. It's really looking at the Performing Arts Department during John Kalacki's tenure as the curator of the department, and really diving into this rich cultural moment across the country and how it resonated at the Walker in terms of a host of queer radical performers who really were engaging with the larger political context in the country at the time, the culture wars coming off the Reagan administration and certainly the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
White House officials confirm that the president has never talked with his Surgeon General about AIDS or read the report Dr. Koop sent him last October.
The fact that it has taken the president 5 years to begin to even address this problem publicly demonstrates that this administration hasn't given it the level of commitment that it deserves.
In terms of performance history, that early moment of the 1990s is really the heyday of solo performance art. So folks like Guillermo Gomez-Pena, Karen Finley, Tim Miller, amongst many others, creating this renaissance for the solo performer to stand on stage, to do radical things. You know, Karen Finley's really iconic piece, We Keep Our Victims Ready. She takes off her clothes. She covers herself in different types of food, overtly political in her stance. She is unapologetically an angry feminist. John Kalacki, during his time, was, as were many arts presenters and organizations across the country, deeply concerned by the attacks against the NEA and deeply concerned about how experimental artists were catapulted to this national stage and really used as pawns in this proxy war over quote-unquote moral future of the country and, of course, the financial future of the NEA.
The senator from North Carolina, Mr. Helms, proposes an amendment number 2396 to the committee amendment on page 81.
The National Endowment for the Arts, and that disgusting, insulting, revolting garbage produced by obviously sick minds is somehow art, and that this art is worthy of being.
All of the artists that you see on display here were really engaged with thinking through questions of radical feminism or queer politics in their work. Ron Athey, a performance artist, the costume and some of the set elements from Ron Vauders, Roy Cohn, Jack Smith, a series of different programs that then performance curator John Kalacki initiated. Dyke Nights, an ongoing sort of cabaret series, video footage of Unsafe, Unsuited, which was an improvised collaboration between Patrick Scully, Ishmael Houston Jones, and Keith Hennessy, who are all improvisational dancers.
Plum, a juicy sweet plum.
Patrick's Cabaret was the venue for Ron Athey's performance and also for a series of queer films. Ron Athey's performance was in 94 was hosted as part of the LGBT film festival. He imagines ritual as engaged in using tattooing, scarification, be cut in front of you. And all of this happens live.
The pending amendment reaches beyond the works of Mr. Athey and his admirers at the National Endowment for the Arts and around the editorial offices of newspapers around the country. The broader issue, I think, is the sober realization that for the past two decades, an unmistakable decadence has saturated American society.
It's a relatively small show, but it really includes some beautiful archival materials.
Again, this story was produced by KFAI's Dixie Trichel. The VA is expanding its use of art therapy for veterans with traumatic brain injuries or post-traumatic stress. It has begun offering telehealth programs in dance, visual art, and music. The program links therapists with veterans in their homes. Bobby O'Brien sat in on a therapy session in Gainesville, Florida.
Music therapist Diane Garrison Langston is sitting in front of two computer screens, has a phone to her ear, and a guitar by her side.
Hey, I can see you.
Yeah, the red light was on my camera for whatever reason.
She's linking up with her 4 o'clock patient, Joshua Lawhorn. He's active duty Army, recovering from a traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress after a couple of tours in Afghanistan. Lawhorn opted for music therapy to help with his memory problems.
Let's pull out the guitar, get it tuned up, and we'll get going.
Lawhorn is sitting in his Ocala apartment, more than an hour's drive south from the Gainesville VA. They chat briefly. Lawhorn tells Langston that he cut his finger while cooking, so playing guitar is difficult.
I've not been practicing as much as I should have.
There's no requirement for how much he's practiced. This is not music lessons. It is music therapy. This is not supposed to be a stressful thing.
If this became more of a chore for me than anything, I would probably just want to stop doing it.
But what keeps him going is the convenience of telehealth. Lawhorn can schedule a session no matter where he is, as long as he has a computer connection, camera, and a microphone. Langston says learning guitar is a good coping skill for Lawhorn.
Not only is it great for regulating fine and gross motor movement, because you have to strum and you have to do this, it's positive cognitive processing because they're learning a new language.
Nationwide, the VA provides telehealth services to more than 700,000 patients a year, and there are more than 40 different programs, including addiction services, women's health care, and pain management. But the Gainesville VA is the first to meld the telehealth technology with creative arts therapy, and hundreds of veterans have enrolled in dance movement, visual art, or music therapy. Dr. Chuck Levy, Chief of Medicine and Rehabilitation for the VA region, oversees the Creative Arts Therapy Program.
There are some indicators that different engagements in arts can lower your blood pressure, can be good for your heart rate. The body of evidence is thinner than it is for other practices, but we need to be doing things now, so off we go.
The Gainesville VA has a 5-year grant to mentor other VA medical centers that want to develop creative arts telehealth programs. It's also working with Sarah Cass through the National Endowment for the Arts. She is a retired Navy physician who saw firsthand the value of creative arts therapy at the Walter Reed National Medical Center.
So often what we need to do in helping patients with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury is understand their story from their perspective. And the arts give us an opportunity to allow them to tell their story in a way that's different than traditional talk therapy.
That traditional therapy didn't help Darlinda Reeves, a 51-year-old Navy veteran and cancer survivor. She participates in visual arts therapy from her home in Jacksonville.
I find it more relaxing and I'm able to really tell what's bothering me without being in a hospital or in a doctor's office where you feel like if you say the wrong thing, you're going to get judged as, oh my God, she's severely depressive, we need to give her some drugs.
Reeves says she's found power by expressing her feelings in pencil drawings using techniques learned during therapy. She's now moving on to photography. Meanwhile, the Telehealth Creative Arts Therapy Program is expanding to 10 locations, including Fort Hood, Texas, Camp Pendleton in California, and Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. I'm Bobby O'Brien.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1507.